All wakened up again and rejected. All wakened up again, forever and ever.
Lizzie, it will be quiet. It will sleep. It did sleep. She shook her head, gripping her handkerchief in her teeth.
Lizzie, I'll write to you.
Her tears had ceased. She put away the handkerchief and the broken mirror, and unwound the yellow scarf.
Don't write, Charles. It's kinder. It's funny. I thought it was the ending then, and it wasn't. It's the ending now. Please don't write to me if you want to be kind. I don't want any more.
She crumpled up the scarf and stuffed it in her pocket. Then she turned and quickly swung open the door, nearly running into Rosina, who was standing just outside. Rosina jumped back, and Lizzie ran away down the stairs, leaning hard on the banister, her high-heeled shoes clattering and slithering. I tried to follow her, but Rosina grasped my arm, exerting quite a lot of force and bracing one of her booted feet against my foot. We reeled against the wall.
"Let her go."
The front door banged. I stood for a moment, staring at the bead curtain, which was swaying and clicking. Then I walked slowly downstairs. Rosina followed me. We went into the kitchen and sat down again at the table.
"Don't worry, Charles. That lusty little animal won't break its heart."
I was silent.
"Now I suppose you want me to discuss poor Lizzie with you?"
"No."
"Poor old Charles. You're demoted as God."
"Okay. Please go."
"If you ever set up with Lizzie Shearer, I'll kill both of you."
"Oh, Rosina, don't be stupid. Don't be vulgar. Just please go away." "Well, I suppose you'd better let Lizzie get a start if you're going back to London."
"I'm not. I'm going to the Raven Hotel to have a very good lunch alone. Then I'm going to Manchester to do some filming. I shall leave you to your thoughts, and I hope they hurt. I won't interfere with your caper with a bearded lady on one condition."
"What?"
"That you promise to tell me everything about it."
"Okay."
"You promise?"
"Yes."
"Get up, Charles."
I rose mechanically to my feet. Rosina came round the table, and for a moment I thought she was going to hit me. She gave me one of her wet kisses.
"Well, goodbye. I'll be back."
The front door banged again, and a moment later I heard the departing scream of the little red car. For a moment only I hoped that Lizzie might return. Then I thought what luck it was that Lizzie had not come running to me after my first letter. I went into the next room and tried to light the fire, but failed. There was not enough kindling wood. I was feeling thoroughly disturbed by Lizzie's crying and Rosina's kiss. I was miserable about Lizzie, but in rather a blank way, and I was reluctant to think about her. I wanted her sympathy. I was already regretting my thoroughly vulgar conversation with Rosina. It had seemed a smart thing to do at the time to tell her about Hartley, but now I was filled with forebodings. In effect, I had given Rosina another weapon. Then I began to wonder a little about Cousin James and how he'd come unstuck. Homosexuality? Or had the army decided that a crazy Buddhist was a bad security risk? My neck was beginning to hurt where Rosina's red fingernails had reached it. I wanted to take my temperature, but could not find the thermometer.
There was no fog now. Twilight had just been overtaken by darkness, and a bright, fierce little moon was shining, dimming the stars and pouring metallic brilliance onto the sea and animating the land with the ghostly, intent presences of quiet rocks and trees. The sky was a clear, blackish blue, entertaining the abundant light of the moon but unillumined by it. The earth and its objects were a thick, fuzzy brown. Shadows were strong, and the brooding identity of everything I passed so powerful that I kept nervously looking back. The silence was vast, different in quality from the foggy silence of the morning, punctured now and then by an owl's cry or the barking of a distant dog. I did not go through the village. I walked along the coast road in the direction of the harbour, through the defile, which I called the Khyber Pass, where the big yellow rocks had invaded the land, heaping themselves up against the side of the hill into a lumpy mound in which a narrow cleft had been cut to allow the passage of the road. The rocks in the moonlight were dark brown, but covered with innumerable sparkling points of light where the moon caught the tiny facets of the quartz. I went through the dark cleft and on past the harbour to where, a little way further on,
There was a footpath which led up the hill, skirting a wood, and joined the tarmac road where it petered out just beyond the bungalows. All this I had checked in a daylight reconnaissance, when I had also worked out how to get into the garden of Niblets. This was not difficult, since the lower end of the garden was separated only by a line of posts, joined by slack wire, from the long sloping field full of gorse bushes and outcrops of rock which bordered the mounting footpath on the village side. The main drawback to my expedition, apart from the nightmarish possibility of being discovered, was that when it was late enough for me to get into the garden unobserved, it might also be late enough for the married pair to be in bed. There was also, of course, the possibility that they might be watching television in silence. I had earlier rejected the idea of spying on Hartley and Ben, not for moral reasons, but because it made me feel sick with emotion and terror. A marriage is so hideously private. Whoever illicitly draws back that curtain may well be stricken, and in some way that he can least foresee, by an avenging deity. Some horrible and quite unexpected revelation could persecute the miscreant henceforth forever with an almost obscene haunting. And I had to struggle here with my own superstitious horror of the married state, that unimaginable condition of intimacy and mutual bondage. However, the logic of the situation now forced this dangerous and distasteful adventure upon me. It was the next step, the attempt to answer the next question. I had to discover, insofar as I could possibly do so, what this marriage was really like, and what these two were for each other. The moon, shining from the sea, was casting the shadows of the wooden posts onto the sloping lawn of Niblets. The grass looked as if it was covered with frost. I had already discerned from below that the curtained picture window of the sitting room was glowing with light. I stepped over the slack wire and began to walk very quietly up the lawn in the direction of the house, listening to my practically noiseless footsteps in the already dewy grass, listening to my deep breathing and to the hurtful beating of my heart. In spite of a little rain earlier, the ground was hard after the sunny weather, and I did not think I would leave noticeable footprints. At about 15 yards from the house I stopped. Except for a small vent at the top, the window was closed. The curtains were unlined, and the light within illumined, like stained glass, a bright design of green parrots in a lemon tree. There was a narrow slit in the centre where the curtains failed to meet. I moved again, then listened. There was a sound of voices. Television? Avoiding the dangerous area of the slit, and feeling as if I were about to hurtle into space, I now nerved myself to move steadily, silently, right up to the window, and to kneel, touching the brick wall, and then to sit down with my head just below the level of the low sill. Anticipating encounters with rose bushes, though not foreseeing the dew, I was wearing a mackintosh. The moonlight had showed me the whereabouts of the various flower beds, but as I approached the house, I must have been dazzled by the lighted window, or else become blind with fear, since I seemed to have sat down on a rose bush. There was a faint, awful crackling sound, and a small, sharp spear pierced the calf of my leg. I sat, awkward, frozen, leaning back against the wall, my eyes and my mouth wide open, suddenly staring at the vast, moonlit sea below me, and waiting with horror for some terrible, "Who's there?" But the voices continued, and now I could hear them quite clearly. How easy it is to spy on unsuspecting people. The experience that followed was so weird and so literally maddening to me that I will not attempt to describe my feelings. I will simply, as in a play, give you the dialogue. It will be clear who is speaking.
"Why did he come here, then?"
"I don't know."
"You keep saying, 'I don't know, I don't know.'
Can't you say anything else? Or are you mentally deficient?
Of course you know, you must know. Do you think I'm a perfect fool? I'm not that thick."
"You don't believe it."
"Don't believe what?"
"You don't believe what you say."
"What on earth do you mean? What do you mean, what did I say, that you think I don't believe? Am I supposed to be a liar, then?"
"You say you think I knew, but you can't think that. It's insane."
"So I'm either mad or a liar, is that it? Is that it?"
"No, no. I don't understand you.
You're babbling. Why did he come here?"
"I don't know. It was an accident. It was a chance.
Funny sort of chance. My God, you're clever. It's the one bloody thing that would torment me more than anything else. Sometimes I think you want to drive me out of my mind and make me mad enough to... Darling, dear heart, dear Binky, please don't. I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's no use saying that you're sorry or that you don't know. That's all you say over and over again. I'd like to split open your head and find out what you do know. Why don't you explain at last? Why don't you admit at last? It's been going on long enough. It'd be a relief to me if you'd only tell me. There's nothing to tell. You expect me to believe that? You did believe it. I never believed it. I just pretended to. Christ. I wanted to forget. I got tired of living with it all. I got tired of living with your dreams. There weren't any dreams. Oh, you bloody... There weren't any dreams! Don't tell lies and don't shout at me either. Oh, God, the lies you've told me. I've lived in a sort of soup of lies ever since the start. And then the boy... No, no. Well, I was pretty thick about it all, but I just couldn't credit. No! Christ! And when I think of other lucky men with their wives and their families, and their simple, decent lives and ordinary love and kindness, while here we've had ordinary love and kindness, and it's only been a pretense because we were both tired. It was too exhausting, to be honest. We got tired of telling each other the truth about the hellish cage we live in. We had to rest sometimes and pretend things were all right when they weren't, and put up with this sham, this bloody sham you call a marriage. We had to stop stabbing ourselves and each other with the ghastly truth. So now we're both sunk in lies, your lies. They're everywhere, like a stinking bog. We're drowning in them. And Jesus, I thought it might be better when we got away, when we got away to the sea. I thought at least I'd have a garden. I thought. But then lo and behold, he's here. That's funny, isn't it? Oh, darling, don't. You do like it here. You did like it here. Well, don't say that to me now. Do you want me to spit in your face? We just pretended to be nice, quiet people. You didn't pretend much. Don't start that again. Well, then, don't you. You'd better be careful. Another thing I've got against you is that you've made me into such a... You've made me so bad... Oh, Christ, why can't we get out? If only you'd tell the truth for once. I just want to know where I am. Why did that man come here, to this village, here to this very place? You keep asking the same questions again and again. I don't know. I didn't want him here. Liar. How often have you seen him? Just that one time. Liar! I actually saw you with him twice, and God knows how many more times you've been with him. Why'd you lie to me so stupidly? And you put him up to calling round here. I didn't. Well, you're not going to see him again. I don't want to. It's the past. The past, the bloody past. There's never been anything for us. Everything's spoilt. You've spoilt everything, you and your darling. Dear, dear Binky, don't. And don't call me pet names. It's a mockery. Can't you just try to be kind to me? To pity me? Just try. Why can't you try? Oh, God, how can you have been so cruel? I'm not cruel. You're mad. You're mad! Don't scream at me. I've had enough screaming. You've screamed your way through life, and now we're nearly at the end of it. God, I wish mine had ended. That's what you've been praying for, I expect. That I'll have a heart attack. Then you can go off with, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Just stop saying that, will you? I'm so tired of it. It means nothing, that parrot cry. Oh, God, I'm so tired. It's all spoilt. It never even got started because of you. And then that unspeakable deception. And I took it. There was no deception. Oh, shut up. I know we've said all this a million times before. We're like clockwork dolls, but Christ, I'm thinking it all the time. I've got to say it now and then. I even accepted that lie because there seemed to be nothing else to do, and I just bloody wanted to be happy. Well, not happy, I know that was impossible, but at least I wanted some peace in my rotten, failed life, and just to rest a bit. But oh no, you wouldn't even let me rest. That's not true. Be careful. Be careful. I thought I hadn't any alternative but to put up with you and your lies. God, I must have been crazy. I ought to have cleared off and left you with... No! You'd have cheered. And now he turns up as bold as brass and comes and rings my doorbell. You must have enjoyed arranging that. Don't say what you don't think. I do think it. What else can I think? I can see when you're lying. Do you think you can take me in? Where have you hidden his letters, eh? Where? There aren't any letters, because you destroyed them. Oh, you're clever. But listen. I say listen. I am listening. Your little plan isn't going to work. What little plan? You want me to say, all right, clear out, I don't care where you go. You want to torment me into letting you go. That's it, isn't it? No. Take that bloody look off your face or I'll... Well, it's not going to be like that, see? I'm not going to let you go. I'm never going to let you go, see? You can stay here and look after me even if we never say another bloody word to each other. See? even if I have to chain you up. Forgive me, please. Forgive me. Don't be so angry. I can't bear it. Stop being angry. It hurts so much. You frighten me so much.
Oh, do stop crying. I'm so fed up with your tears. Why did he come here? What's it all about? That's what I want to know. Christ, can't you tell me the truth at last? I'm tired of living in a bad dream and pretending it's all right. All this bloody house we took so much trouble with, the bloody furniture, the garden, those fucking roses. Pretense, pretense, pretense. I'd like to smash it all to pieces. Why can't you tell me the truth? Why has he turned up here? What does it mean?
Please, you're hurting me. Please, please, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
What does it mean?
Oh, stop. I'm so sorry.
I have written this out as I remember it, with the repetitions. I have not attempted to describe, and will not now, the tones of voice, his strident shout, her whining, tearful apologies. I shall never forget it. The eavesdropper had indeed got what he came for. I wanted to go away much sooner, but I was paralysed, partly by horror, partly by a physical cramp, since I had sat down in an awkward, uncomfortable position and had not dared to move since. At last I rolled over and crawled away down the wet, shorn, moon-grey lawn. I got stiffly to my feet, got clear of the garden, and began to run down the footpath into the face of the sinking moon. I ran most of the way home. I drank some whiskey and took a sleeping pill and went to bed and rushed headlong into sleep. I dreamt I found a new secret room at Shraff End and a woman lying dead in it. The next day I was like a madman. I rambled, almost ran, round the house, round the lawn, over the rocks, over the causeway, up to the tower. I ran about like a frenzied animal in a cage which batters itself painfully against the bars, executing the same pitiful leaps and turns again and again. There was a golden mist, gradually clearing. It would be a hot day. I looked with amazement on my familiar swimming places, and on the gentle, crafty lapping of the calm sea against the yellow rocks. I ran back to the kitchen, but could not even make myself a cup of tea. "What am I to do? Oh, what am I to do?" I kept saying to myself out loud. And the strange thing was that although I had received full and complete and running over exactly the evidence which I wanted, I seemed to be distracted with grief and fear and a kind of nausea now that I had it. I had not understood the whole of the conversation. At moments I felt that I had hardly understood anything except for what was so obscenely evident, those terrible tones of voice and the sense that all this had happened before again and again. The awful crying of souls in guilt and pain, loathing each other, tied to each other. The inferno of marriage. I could not, and did not try to, work out the meanings and implications of what had been said. Clearly the gentleman, I now suddenly started thinking of him as the gentleman, was displeased by my appearance on the scene. Well, too bad. I indulged in visions of going up to Niblett's, grabbing him by the collar when he opened the door, and pounding his face. But that would be no use. Besides, he was scarcely the dear, dull old husband imagined by Rosina. He might have a stiff leg, but he was a tough customer. He was, or perhaps just seemed to be, a dangerous man. He might be the classical bully who is supposed to collapse when threatened, but those who consider threatening bullies may well doubt whether this convenient type really exists. There would be no point in such an experiment. I simply had to get Hartley away. And I had to think how to do it. Thought was difficult. In my earlier reflections, I had somehow vaguely taken it for granted that once it was clear, if it should become clear that Hartley's marriage was a disaster, it would not be hard for me to break it up and remove her. I did not doubt that, in those circumstances, she would want to come, that to run to me at last would be a blessed, joyful escape, and the acting out of a long-cherished fantasy. This assumption may seem naive, but it was not any sense of its naivety which now set me at a loss. It was simply that, having been pressed up to the point of action, I could not think exactly how to act, and the details mattered terribly. Niblett's, its roses, its horrible new carpets, the brass ornaments, the lurid curtains, the bell, impressed me not at all. These were gauzy, visionary. As he had said, pretenses. What impressed me was some quality of that awful conversation itself, some sense of the many, many years which had passed, a sense of the strength and texture of the cage. Yet it could still be that I had only to say to Hartley, "Come," and she would come. Then it remained to decide just how and when to say it, and that decision seemed to raise all the obscure difficulties again. Was it simply perhaps the case that I was afraid of Ben? About 11 o'clock I stopped, running, and made some tea. There was an idea which I had received from the conversation, but for some time, although it was there, I could not chisel it out or identify it. It was an idea which the gentleman himself had given me. It was something like, supposing he really were to turn her out, supposing he could be driven to reject her. Would that not solve the problems about that cage which I had found so hard to formulate? The gentleman had said that he never would drive her away, but the fact that he mentioned it at all showed that it was possible. Let him dement himself with his own foul temper, and foul jealousy, or whatever it was, for indeed I could not quite see what it was, that he was so enraged about. It was surely not just my appearance. The old school friend, now a celebrity, knocking upon the door, unwelcome as that doubtless was. If he could become sufficiently worked up, if things over there could just collapse and crumble, then she would have no refuge, and she would have no cage, and she would come running straight into my arms. Yet, if he became mad, if his world began to totter, might he not then maim her, or murder her? This was one of the thoughts that sent me skipping round the rocks like a crazed leopard. Her cry at the end, "Stop, stop, you're hurting me," how often in those hateful years had that cry rung out? It was unbearable. I leapt up, upsetting my teacup, chattering aloud, and ran out again onto the grass. What was I to do? So many things were now clear, but I simply could not think out the final tactics. I could not think, and I could not think because I could not clear my mind of that ghastly conversation. It obstructed me like thick adhesive scum. I had to rescue Hartley, and rescue was indeed now at last plainly the word, the very word that I had longed for. But now it came to it. How? Later on it seemed as if Hartley herself had come to my assistance. I saw her gentle, pale, unhappy face looking at me, and I felt a ghostly calm, as if a waft of her presence had come. I must, I realized, before making any overt move at all, talk to her again, and if possible more than once. My impulse was to go round to that horrible bungalow straight away and simply remove her, and in the end it might come to that. But, of course, I must prepare her. If it came to a swoop, there must be no bungling, no mistakes. So much had been happening in my mind of which she knew nothing. I must let her know where, in it all, I was. I decided that it was no use at present attempting any more meetings in the village, since she would be too upset and frightened to attend properly. The vital explanations must be done by letter. I had assumed that what she feared, not yet knowing what my intentions were, was her own heart. For all she knew, I had other sentimental commitments. She had had, no doubt, enough of remorse and the quiet mourning of an old love, so foolishly rejected. Now, however, I could glimpse other and more urgent fears, and I felt sick, uneasy anger at the idea of that little, boyish, jealous man sitting up there with his field glasses and waiting for her to come home. It soon seemed plain, and this further clarification was a relief, that I must simply write her a long letter, then give her time to understand it, to respond to it, and by then it was a relief to my shocked, frightened mind to reflect that there was now no terrible hurry, that I did not have to go up that hill today and decide exactly how to confront the jealous tyrant. There was the problem of conveying the letter to her, but that was not insoluble, and I had in fact already envisaged how it might be done. I ate some corned beef with red cabbage and pickled walnuts, and the remainder of the apricots and cheddar cheese. I had no bread or butter or milk, as I had been too distracted to do any shopping. After that I rested. After that I wrote some of this diary, bringing it more nearly up to date. After that I wrote the letter to Hartley, the text of which I will copy out in a little while. After that I washed a lot of clothes and put them out in the sun. After that I went swimming from the tower steps. Then I sat beside the tower and looked at the late afternoon sun making big, blotchy shadows behind the spherical rocks of Raven Bay. After that, Since I saw some tourists coming and I had nothing on, I got dressed and returned to the house and picked up my washing, which had dried. Then I fetched the snapshots of Hartley, which I'd brought from London, and sat outside on my stone seat beside my stone trough, and brooded on them slowly and intently. Some of the snaps showed us both together. Who had taken those? I could not remember. From the browned, curled surfaces out of a sinless world, the bright, soft, unformed young faces gazed forth. It was an unspoilt world, a world of truly simple and pure pleasures, a happy world, since my trust in her was absolute, and since in our childish, old-fashioned chastity we did not yet consider making love. Happier we were in this, I think, than the children of today. The light of pure love and of pure, unanxious romance illuminated our days together, our nights apart. This is no absurd idealization of a youthful Arcadia. We were simple children in a simple world. We loved our parents and our teachers and were obedient to them. The pains of the human journey lay in the future, the terrible choices, the unavoidable crimes. We were free to love. When did it begin to end? Perhaps when I ran off to London. Yet even then our love had still a time to run, and I never doubted her until the last. How long, how much did she deceive me? Perhaps my selfish need of her was so great that I could not conceive of it not being satisfied. And as I reflected on that need, it also occurred to me to think how much, in those years, Hartley had defended me against James. It seemed odd now that they knew practically nothing of each other. I scarcely ever spoke of James to Hartley, and never then of Hartley to James. She never knew how robustly her love defended me against some kind of collapse of my pride. I shall now transcribe the letter which I wrote to Hartley, and which I had decided to find some way of delivering to her on the following day. My dearest Hartley, my darling, I love you, and I want you to come to me. This is what this letter says. But first there are things which I must tell you, things which I must explain. The chance which has brought you back to me has come like a great storm into my life. There is so much to say, so much to tell. It may seem to you that I belong now to some other world, to some great world of which you know nothing, and that I must have in that world many friends, many relationships. It is not so. In many ways my life in the theatre now seems like a dream. The old days with you, the only reality. I have few friends and no amorous ties. I am alone and free. This was what I was not able properly to tell you when we met in the village. I have had a successful career, but an empty life. That is what it comes to. I never conceived of marrying because I knew there was only one woman that I would or could marry. Hartley, think about that. Believe it. I have waited for you, although I never dared to hope that I would ever see you again. And now, fleeing from worldly vanities, I have come to the sea, and to you. And I love you as I always did. My old love is there, every little fibre and tentacle and tendril of it intact and sensitive and alive. Of course I am older, and it is in that sense a different man's love, and yet it is the same love. For it has kept its identity, it has travelled with me all this way, it has almost miraculously survived. Oh, my dear, how many days and nights there have been when you knew nothing of it, when perhaps you thought of me as far away in my grand world, when I have sat alone with an aching heart, thinking of you, remembering you, and wondering where you were. How is it that people can vanish so that we know not where they are? Hartley, I never stopped wanting you. I want you now. I have come to know, never mind how, but I do know that you are most unhappily married. I know that you live with a tyrannical, perhaps violent, man. I wonder how often in the past you may have wished to escape, and have sunk back, defeated and wretched, because there was nowhere to escape to. Hartley, I am offering you, now, my home, my name, my eternal devotion. I am still waiting for you, my only love. Will you not come? Will you not escape to me, to be with me inseparably for the years that remain? Oh, Hartley, I could make you so happy. I know I could. But let me also say this.
If I thought that you were happy already, happy in your marriage, I would not dream of disturbing you with declarations of my persisting love. I would suffer my love silently, even perhaps dissemble it, perhaps go away. I suspect, and forgive me for glancing at this, that you may have suffered more than 1 hour of remorse as you thought of me living my exciting life, and how utterly, as it seemed, you had lost me. But if I thought that nevertheless you had even a moderately contented or reasonably endurable life, I would not meddle. I would gaze at you from afar and turn away. But knowing you to be very unhappy, I cannot and will not pass by. How could I, loving you as I do, let you go on suffering? Hartley, you must and you will come to me, to the place where you ought always to have been. Do not be upset or frightened by wondering what to do about this letter. There is no need for you to do anything immediately, even to reply. I wanted simply to tell you of my love and my readiness. It is for you to consider when and how you are to respond. Obviously, I'm not necessarily expecting you to come running to my house at once, but when you have reflected, when you have got used to the idea of coming back to me, coming back to me, my dearest girl, then perhaps you will begin to consider how to start to do it. And then we shall be ready to talk to each other, and we shall find the means to talk. Let us quietly take one step at a time, one step at a time. When you can give me some sign that you are prepared to let me look after you forever, then I will think what we are to do, and I will, when you desire it, take charge. Do not worry, my Hartley. All will be well, you will see. All will be well. For a day or two, or a few days, as you will, just think about what I have told you. Then, when you will, write me a letter, and send it by post. That is, for the present, best. Do not worry, do not fear. I will find means of communicating with you. I will love you and cherish you, and do my most devoted best to make you happy at last. Yours always, as once, now, and in all the years. Your faithful Charles. P.S. Come to me anyway. Of course there are no conditions. Just let me help you and serve you. You can then decide freely and in peace where and how you want to live. I wrote this letter quickly and passionately and without corrections. When I read it through, I was at first tempted to alter it because it sounded, well, at moments a bit self-important, a little pompous, a little histrionic, perhaps. Then I thought, no. This is my voice. Let her hear it. She will hardly be, as she reads this letter, in a critical mood. If I were to amend and polish it, it might sound insincere and lose its force. And as for self-centred, of course I am self-centred. Let her indeed be sure that I am pursuing my own interests here, and not just altruistically hers. Let her know that she can give me happiness by giving herself freedom. And when I had written the letter and satisfied myself that it would serve, I put it in an envelope upon which I typed her name and address. I am a poor typist, and I wrote the letter in longhand. I then sat and brooded, and allowed myself to be almost hopeful, almost happy. Later on, as recorded above, I swam. The sea was cool about my warm limbs, coating them with its cool scales. The water undulated calmly, smooth and shining upon the surface, like the rind of a fruit. Even without my curtain rope, which the playful sea has again untied, I managed to climb out easily. As I write this now, it is the next day, and the letter to Hartley in its fat envelope still lies upon my sea-facing table in the drawing-room. I have been writing this diary during the morning. Soon I shall have lunch. The remains of the corned beef with plain boiled onions. Plain boiled onions are another dish fit for a king. I finished the red cabbage last night with scrambled eggs and drank a lot of the Raven Hotel Spanish white wine. A mistake. I must shop soon. I crave for fruit, for buttered toast, for milk in my tea. The shop lady said there might be cherries this week. Why am I delaying? Waiting? Why am I almost pretending that life is ordinary, that it is as it once was? I am still floating in a sense of achievement, of a well-merited interim. I sought and found my crucial evidence. I have decided what to do and how to do it. I have spoken to her eloquently, definitively, although my words have not yet reached her. It is as if they are still winging their way through the air, going to her breast.
Am I afraid? Is that the real reason why I am waiting? To give her the letter in safety may prove hard, and the results of a bungled failure unthinkable, but it is not this obstacle I fear. The sooner I give her the letter, the sooner I shall know her response. What will it be? If she says no, or if she does not reply, I shall, of course, assume that she is simply inhibited by fear. But what shall I do then? And how long can I wait before I move again? And what on earth shall I do as I wait? That interim will not be a calm one. Better, then, to prolong this one. I feel, since I heard that conversation, so much more and dreadfully involved with both of them. I have family membership. With this come hatred, jealousy, the familiar demons. And then again, suppose she simply uses me for her freedom and then leaves me after. Is that conceivable? Could I lose her a second time? Could she vanish? I should run mad. I felt bound, after reading the letter, to add that postscript. It seemed honourable to do so, but is it wise? Perhaps I had better delete it. Better that she should assume that in running to me she commits herself. I must try to see and feel these speculations as premature and pointless. But I understand very well why I sit here and look at the letter and do not want, just yet, to deliver it. I will now describe what happened next, much of which was entirely unexpected. I delayed, in fact, after writing the above, no longer than the evening of that day. The dilatory calm which I described was quite suddenly succeeded by a frenzy of desperate, impatient anxiety to know my fate at once. I then set out to put my delivery plan into operation. I put on a light mackintosh and a shabby sun hat, put the letter in my pocket without deleting the postscript, and slung round my neck a pair of field glasses which James had given me for bird-watching when we were schoolboys. I cannot recall that I ever used them to watch birds. It was a tacit custom of our childhood that James gave me presents, often quite expensive ones, whereas I gave him none. I suppose my parents accepted this as an inescapable aspect of the patronage of the poor by the rich, and it only much later occurred to me that of course the presents were really from Uncle Abel and Aunt Estelle. These glasses were not very powerful, and not to be compared with Ben's wife-watching pair, but I thought they would serve. I went by the inland route, which I had taken before, through the marsh and round by Amorne Farm and into the village from the other side. My objective was the wood which lay beyond the field which bordered Niblett's garden. I saw from the Ordnance Survey map that a little road leading off to the right at the entrance to the village just before the church circled away up the hill and through the upper part of the wood which lay above the bungalows. Thus I could make the whole circuit without at any time coming within viewing range. I climbed the hill, becoming rather hot and tired, and soon found an inviting woodland path which led seawards at a point a little, as I guessed, beyond the end of the Niblett's road. In a few minutes I could see the open light of the field, and then was able to peer out through the tree trunks at the now moderately distant bungalow, which I kept under close observation through the glasses. I waited for quite a long time, feeling cooler, then rather cold, although the sun was still shining. My arms and my eyes were beginning to ache. At last the gentleman came out. My temperature shot up, and my heart beat a good deal faster. I was glad to note that he was carrying a garden fork. I could see his long evening shadow moving down the lawn. It gave me a certain pleasure to have Ben, all unsuspecting, in my sights as he had had me. I have never handled a real gun, but I have handled many a stage gun, and I know what it feels like. Near to the bottom of the garden he started paying attention to one of the fussy flower-beds, poking about rather aimlessly at first. Then suddenly he started hitting something with the fork. Not digging, but hitting. What was he hitting? A slug? A wild flower? What was he thinking about while with such terrible concentration he destroyed that innocent little thing? I was fascinated, but there was no time to lose. I began to move up the hill under cover of the wood, observing him at intervals as I went, until I reached a point opposite the top of the road, where a distance of some 200 yards of open grass separated me from the end of the tarmac, and where Ben was about to disappear from view, divided from me by the bungalow. I reckoned that there would be 2 or 3 seconds, after I emerged into the open, during which it would be possible for him to see me. I took a last look at him. He had his back to me, now crouching beside the flowerbed. I walked with long, careful, fast strides across the first bit of grass, then sprinted to the road and straight through the gate up the path to the front door. Here I did not ring the bell. That sickly, high-pitched ding-dong might well have carried upon the evening air. I tapped upon the door with my knuckles, using an old code which Hartley and I had used as children, when we used to knock softly upon the doors of each other's houses. After a short moment she opened the door. The shocked response to my tap had been, as I hoped, automatic. We stared at each other, gaping, both terrified. I saw her staring, amazed, frightened eyes. I thrust the letter towards her awkwardly. I could not find her hand, and it almost fell between us. Then she had it, clutched against her skirt, and I turned and ran, instinctively taking the way down the hill, down the road into the village. I had not, in fact, planned my retreat, as my thinking had ended with the delivery of the letter, and as I was passing the Black Lion, I reflected that it might have been better to have gone back the way I came. However, as I strode along the village street and turned onto the footpath, well in the possible purview of Ben's glasses, I felt reckless and strong, so that even my recent caution seemed cowardly. Was Ben still bending over his flowerbed? Or was he inside the house, tearing my letter out of Hartley's hands? I almost felt I did not care. I almost felt it would be better if he were, at this very moment, reading my words and shaking with jealous rage. His reign of terror was nearing its end. It was certainly not dark as I came towards the house, but the day had that luminous, gauzy blandness which in the midsummer season celebrates the approach of a twilight which, for a few final days, will never entirely darken. The evening star was just visible, and would now, for a long further period of daylight, blaze in splendour alone. The sea was as flat as I had ever seen it, quite still, and held up, brimming, as if it were in a bowl, the tide being in. The water was the colour of very light blue enamel. Two seabirds, gannets, flying low in the middle distance, produced a hazy, distorted reflection as upon a convex metal surface. As I walked along the road, past the handsome milestone which read, Nero Dean, 1 mile, a faint air of warmth was wafted from the yellow rocks which had been basking in the sun all day. The house, by contrast, felt cold, and seemed to be up to some of its tricks. After the brilliant, colour-bestowing light outside, the air within seemed grey and a little thick. There were faint sounds, perhaps just the bead curtain clicking in the draught from the open door. I stood in the hall for a few moments, listening. I wondered if the accursed Rosina had come back and was hiding somewhere about to scare me. I felt impelled to make a search, upstairs, downstairs, in the funny middle rooms. No one, of course. As I went through the house, I opened all the doors and windows wide and let the warm, sea-fresh air from the encircling rocks circulate within. I threw off my disguising hat and mackintosh and pulled my shirt out of my trousers. I took a large glass of sweet sherry and bitters out onto the grass and stood there for some time, rising on my toes and falling back on my heels, and watching the bats, and wondering whether Hartley was all right, and what she had done with that long letter after she had read it. Burnt it? Shoved it down the lavatory? Rolled it up in a pair of stockings? I came inside and filled the large and now empty glass with white wine, and opened a tin of olives and a tin of Korean smoked clams, and a packet of dry biscuits. There was no fresh food, as, of course, I had once more omitted to shop. The house was still acting up, but I felt by now that I was getting to know its oddities, and I was more friendly towards it. It was not exactly a sinister or menacing effect, but as if the house were a sensitized plate, which intermittently registered things which had happened in the past. Or, it now occurred to me for the first time, were going to happen in the future. A premonition. I began to feel cold, and put on the white Irish jersey. It was now more gloomy inside, though it seemed to be getting even brighter outside, and I had to peer carefully as I washed and drained the olives and put them in a bowl and poured olive oil over them. And then someone began knocking very violently upon the front door. Whoever it was had evidently not noticed the bell, whose brass handle had been painted black. There was also an old tarnished knocker in the form of a dolphin, and now the dolphin's heavy head was being cracked down onto the door with a force which seemed to shake the whole house. Fear immediately grasped me and jerked me to my feet. Rosina? No, Ben, the outraged husband, he had seen the letter. Oh, God, what a fool I had been. I ran out, intending to bolt the door against him, but sheer terror confused me into a desire to confront the worst, and I opened it instead. Hartley flew into the house like a terrified bird. She was alone. In the first seconds, she seemed to be as amazed and confused as I was. Perhaps she was blinded by the sudden dark of the interior. She stood there, clutching her face with her hands as if she were about to scream. I, with a crazed clumsiness, left the door wide open, then, hurrying to shut it, bumped into her. I felt the warmth of her thigh as I blundered past. I got the door shut, then realized that I was saying, "Oh, oh, oh," and that she, too, was uttering some incoherent sound. I put out a grasping, searching hand and touched her shoulder. She made a gesture as if she were about to speak, but by then I had grabbed her, clumsily again but effectively enough, in my arms and gathered her into that bear hug that I had for so long been dreaming of. I lifted her off her feet and heard her gasp as almost the whole length of her body was crushed against me. Then, as I slowly let her down in the fuzzy grey dark of the hall, with the curtain upstairs meditatively clicking, we stood perfectly quiet and silent. I, with both my arms wrapped around her, she with her two hands gripping my shirt. Relaxing at last as she sighed and fluttered her hand against my ribs, I said,
"Is he outside?"
"No."
"Does he know you're here?"
"No."
"Did you destroy the letter?"
"Pardon?"
"Did you destroy the letter?"
"Yes."
"He didn't see it?"
"No."
"Good. Come in here and sit down." I pulled her into the kitchen and pushed her down into a chair beside the table. Then I went back and locked the front door. I tried to light a lamp in the kitchen, but my hands were trembling too much, and the wick flared up and went out. I lit a candle and pulled the curtains. Then I drew up a chair and sat close beside her and cradled her more gently in my arms, her knees touching my knees. "Oh, my darling, you've come. Oh, my precious darling.
Charles,
don't say anything yet. I just want to know that you're here. I'm so happy.
Listen, I—"
"Please, darling, oh, please don't talk. And please don't push me away like that."
"No, but I must talk. There's so little time."
"There's plenty of time, all the time. You did read the letter, didn't you?"
"Yes, of course."
"And that's why you're here?"
"Yes."
"And that's all that matters. You're staying here. You've come, haven't you?"
"Yes, but only to explain—"
"Hartley, don't. What is there to explain? Everything is explained already. I love you. You're here. You love me. You need me. Don't resist. Let's go away to London. Tomorrow morning. Tonight. Never mind about clothes. I'll buy you clothes. You're my wife now." I held her at arm's length, gripping her shoulder with one hand, while with the other I moved the candle so that it illuminated her face. The eyes were thickly encased in wrinkles. The eyelids were brown and pitted, as if stained. The cheeks were flabby and soft, not rounded, and faintly pink, perhaps with hastily applied powder. Her short, grey, undulating hair was dry and brittle-looking, no doubt from years and years of absent-minded visits to inept hairdressers. Now she was past caring about it, and a forgotten slide hung down from the end of one twisted tress. The face was dry. Dry, save where her tongue now moistened her unpainted lips, and where her blue eyes, those strangely timeless pools, were moist and now suddenly full of unshed tears. She moved her shoulder, pulling weakly away, and I released her. It was the first time since our reunion that I had really studied her face, and I felt with a deep triumphant joy how really unchanged that dear face was, and how little it mattered to my love that she was old. Now, too, I saw in her face, though it looked both anxious and sad, something of the animation of youth. I recognized and realized how much I had forgotten, the shape of her mouth, so much prettier without the lipstick. I kissed her, gently, briefly, on the familiar mouth, as we used to kiss, and there was an intelligence in her quiet, negative reception of the kiss which was itself a communication. She said, "I've changed so much. I'm a different person. You were so kind in your letter, but it can't be like that.
You care about old times, but that's not me. It is you. I recognized you in the kiss.
It was true. The kiss had transfigured her, like a kiss in a fairy tale. I remembered the feel, the texture, the movement of her mouth, and all that awkwardness was gone, that sense which I had had in the church of the impossibility of holding her. Our bodies were suddenly in tension, in the same space, moved by the same forces. When I felt this, I wanted to shout with joy, but I kept a quiet tone, wanting to coax her into speech, not wanting to affright her. Hartley, it's a miracle. I gave up the theatre. I came here to solitude, and I found you. I came here for you, I realize it now. But you didn't know I was here. No, yet I've been searching for you. I've always been searching for you. She said, "It can't be like that," and lifted up her hand as if to conceal her face. Then she put her hand on the table, where I covered it firmly with mine. "Charles, listen, I must talk to you. There's so little time." With the back of her other hand she touched her eyes and caused the unshed tears to fall. Then she said, "Oh, Charles, my dear," and bowed her head and thrust it towards me with a dog-like movement. I stroked the dry, brittle hair. I gently undid the hanging slide and put it in the pocket of my trousers. "You'll stay with me forever now, Hartley." She raised her head and mopped her eyes again, this time with a sleeve of the green cotton coat which she was wearing over the yellow dress which I had seen before. "Hartley, take off your coat. I want to see you. I want to touch you. Take it off." "No, it's cold here." I pulled at the coat and she took it off. There was an intense charm in these movements, as if they were the merest innocent spiritual symbol of undressing a woman, something that angels might play at without quite understanding. I touched her breasts, where they pressed warmly, firmly against the yellow stuff of the round-necked dress. I was delighted by the absence of any attempt to attract. This was a novelty in my life. The face powder was a careless habit. The dress was sloppy, nothing. The new, unpainted lips were, I felt, alone a tribute to me. A woman who has long stopped working on her appearance cannot suddenly become smart and sleek. I was delighted that Hartley, as she was, attracted me. I felt proud, possessive, relieved, as if some lifelong terror had been removed, and I thought, I'll buy her such lovely clothes. Not flashy smart, but just right for her. I'll look after her. "Charles, I must just talk to you quickly. I just came to talk after your letter, before he comes back. Where is he?" I had forgotten his existence. "He's at his woodwork."
"Woodwork?"
"Yes, his woodwork class. It's a boat-building class, really, only they do woodwork. I don't think he'll ever build a boat. It's shelves this week. It's the only evening he's out, so I had to come now. They go on till quite late. I think they drink beer afterwards."
"I don't want to talk about him," I said. And I thought, if only I had a car and could drive, I'd take her right away now. This instant.
"Charles, listen, please. I haven't come to you like you think, like you said in the letter you wanted. That isn't possible. I've just come to tell you some things, and, oh, Charles, it's so extraordinary to see you. I thought it could never be, that it was a sort of impossibility of the world, that we two could ever be together again. I never thought I ever would see you again and touch you. It's like a dream."
"That's better. Only it's not a dream. Your life without me has been a dream. You are awaking from a dream, a nightmare. Oh, why did you ever leave me? How could you have done? I nearly died of grief."
"We can't talk about that now."
"Yes, we can. I want to talk about the old days. I want us to remember everything, to understand everything, to relive everything, to establish ourselves together as one being that ought never to have been divided. Why did you leave me, Hartley? Why did you run away?"
"I don't know. I can't remember."
"You must remember. It's like a riddle. You've got to remember."
"I can't. I can't."
"Hartley, you've got to. You said that I wouldn't be faithful to you. Was it really that? You can't have thought that. You knew how much I loved you."
"You went to London."
"Yes, but I had to. I wasn't leaving you. I thought about you all the time. You know that. I wrote to you every day. It wasn't anyone else, was it? It wasn't him."
Strangely enough, this terrible thought had only just this moment come to me.
"No. Hartley, did you know him then? Did you know him before you left me?" I can't remember.
Of course you can remember! Please stop, please.
The way she spoke these words, almost mechanically, with a kind of evasive animal instinct, words so like those which I had overheard her say so recently, made me want to cry out with pain and rage, and a sort of awful pity for her.
Did you know him then?
It doesn't matter.
It does matter. Every little tiny thing matters and must be found again and must be picked up and must be redeemed. We've got to relive the past and clarify it and purify it. We've got to save each other at last, to make each other whole again. Don't you see?
I didn't know him then. He was sort of engaged to one of my cousins, to Edna, you remember. Well, no, you won't. And then she dropped him and I felt sorry for him.
But where did you meet him? Was it after you ran away?
Yes, I went away to one of my aunties at Stoke-on-Trent, where Edna was. I didn't know him when we were together. It wasn't that. It wasn't anything. I didn't want you to be an actor. It wasn't anything. Please don't.
But, Hartley, do be calm and answer my questions. I'm not angry with you, and it is important.
You didn't want me to be an actor?
You never said so.
I did. I wanted you to go to the university.
But, Hartley... It can't have been just that.
It wasn't just anything. Oh, don't upset me so. We were too much like brother and sister, and you were so sort of bossy, and I decided I didn't want to.
Some tears spilled again.
Have you got a handkerchief?
I brought her a clean tea towel, and she wearily wiped her eyes, her face, her neck. A button had come off the tight yellow dress at her breast. I had an impulse to grab her and tear the dress. I sat down again.
Hartley, if you had all these misgivings, why didn't you utter them? We could have done something about it. It was so terrible to go away without a word. It was wicked.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I had to go like that. It was the only way. It wasn't easy.
Oh, it's cold. It's so cold. I must put my coat on again.
She put it on and pulled it round her, turning up the collar. How can it have happened? You can't simply have decided. There must be something else, something you haven't told me. Do you remember that day?
Charles, there isn't time, and I really can't remember. It's so long ago. It's a lifetime ago.
To me, it's yesterday. I've been living with it ever since, reliving it and recalling it and going over and over it and wondering what went wrong and what happened to you and where you were. I think I've wondered where you were every day of my life. And I've been alone all this time. I've stayed in freedom because of you.
It's yesterday, Hartley. That was the only real time I ever lived through.
Alone? I'm sorry. It took me a moment to realize that she was not being sarcastic.
Alone?
Well, yes. Her tone suggested that she had not imagined, not speculated.
You say you just decided you didn't want me.
But that isn't an explanation. I want to know.
Oh, stop. It just didn't happen. If I'd loved you enough, I would have married you. If you'd loved me enough, you would have married me. There aren't any reasons.
You say, if I'd loved you enough. Don't drive me mad. I loved you to the limit. I still do. I tried to the limit. I didn't run away. I didn't marry anyone else. It was all your fault. You'll drive me crazy if you start.
We mustn't talk of these things. We're just sort of plunging about, and it doesn't mean anything now.
Look, I must tell you certain things, only you won't listen.
I thought, I mustn't go mad with emotion. I must stop questioning her now, though I will find out. I will.
Hartley, have some wine.
I poured out a glass of the Spanish wine, and she began mechanically to sip it.
Have an olive.
I don't like olives. They're sour. Please listen to me.
I'm sorry it's so cold here. This house manages to be cold even when...
All right, you tell me things.
But just remember... You're here, and you stay. Whatever happened or didn't happen in the past, you belong to me now.
But tell me one thing.
That night when you were on the road here and that car shone its lights on you, were you coming to see me then, that night?
No, but I just wanted to look at your house.
It was a woodwork night, you see. You wanted to look at my house. To stand in the road and look at the lighted windows.
Oh, my dear, you do love me. You can't help it.
Charles, it doesn't matter.
What do you mean? You'll make me mad again.
There isn't any place, any possibility, any sort of structure. Everything's broken down. You'll understand when I've told you what I came to tell you. All right, I'll listen now. But first, let me kiss you. Then everything will be well. The kiss of peace.
I leaned over and very gently but persistingly let my dry lips touch her wet lips.